Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
U.S. officials maintain that they attacked a safe house for foreign fighters, not a wedding party, when they struck a home in the Iraqi desert near the Syrian border yesterday. Officials say they came away from the operation with weapons and about $1,000. Here's Brigadier General Mark Kimmett this morning.
We believe that the target location was that of a foreign fighter sanctuary, and we took the obligatory actions as the coalition and the Iraqi security forces to ensure that the people of Iraq stay safe.
According to Iraqi officials, up to 40 people died in the incursion, many of them children. Also today, a raid on the home of Governing Council member Ahmed Chalabi. An aide says Chalabi was targeted because of statements he's made demanding that Iraqis be given full control of oil revenues and the country's security. Haider Massawi is an aide to Ahmed Chalabi.
This is part of a political pressure on the Iraqi National Congress and on Dr. Chalabi to change its stance from the issue of full sovereignty back to Iraq and the forming of the new Iraqi government. But it will not sway the INC from its stance because it's not just about the INC, it's about the entire population of Iraq.
Luke Baker is covering the story for Reuters. He joins us from Baghdad. And Luke, there are varying reports on Mr. Chalabi's home raid. Chalabi claims that computers were seized, pictures were broken, a gun held to his head. First of all, who participated in the raid, U.S. soldiers or Iraqi police?
Well, I was in the scene of the raid while it was still going on in this upmarket neighborhood of Baghdad where Chalabi has his offices and his home. And there were a number of U.S. troops on the scene. They had sealed off a large area of this neighborhood, and Iraqi police were there, too. Chalabi himself said that it was Iraqi police only who entered his home. They said they entered with pistols as he was sleeping, woke him up and tried to throw them out, and they said that they were there on orders and they were going to remain. At this point, the only person whose word we have for what was taken is Chalabi's. We've tried to get comment from Iraqi police and from U.S. Officials in Iraq. The U.S. Dan Snow, spokesperson for the Coalition Provisional Authority here, has said that it was a warrant issued by the Iraqi police and it was an Iraqi police issue, and the Iraqi police themselves haven't yet commented.
Well, in fact, we saw Dan Senior's statement. He seemed to be brushing off any U.S. responsibility for the raid on Chalabi.
Well, that's right. While at the same time, Chalabi seemed to be, in his press conference, seemed to be putting an awful lot of onus on the Coalition Provisional Authority, saying that he seemed to believe that several issues that he butted heads with them on, including the de-ratification process, that's the process of ridding members of the former regime from public office in Iraq, the oil for food program and how that should be, the corruption there should be investigated, and how this whole process of sovereignty should be implemented, whether it's really going to be a process of handing over true sovereignty to Iraqis. All those issues, Ahmed Chalabi has butted heads with authorities, U.S. authorities in Iraq, and those issues, and he seems to believe that this raid is in some way linked.
Luke, I should say we are talking to you in Baghdad. We have kind of a tough phone line, but it seems as if you're reiterating that Ahmed Chalabi is laying the blame squarely on U.S. forces. Why would that be happening, though? What is this all about? What's your guess?
Well, we've seen Ahmed Chalabi, as I said, butting heads with the U.S. administration repeatedly over in recent months. He's really taking a very different line. He feels very strongly about the sovereignty issue. When sovereignty is handed over on June 30th, July 1, Ahmed Chalabi is calling for a complete handover of sovereignty, including things like oil revenue, controlled by Iraqis, the armed forces in the country. And these aren't issues that the U.S. Authorities in Iraq are willing to negotiate on at this point. They see it much more as a process of handing over ministries and that sort of thing to Iraqis, but not the control of key centers like the oil and obviously security issues. But it's also more than that. Chalabi, you know, I think he's becoming a somewhat disaffected fellow. He was, you know, one of Washington's top allies, but a lot of things have backfired on him. As we know, he was one of the key sources for information in the build-up to the war on weapons of mass destruction. But it now seems as if he may have been barking up the wrong tree. There hasn't been any evidence of weapons of mass destruction in the country. So he's become something of a poison commodity, I think, for the U.S. authorities in the country.
Hmm. Well, Luke, thank you so much. And again, we apologize to our listeners for this phone line. Sometimes that happens when you call Baghdad.
All right. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Luke Baker covering the unfolding stories for Reuters in Baghdad. Seven more Palestinians were killed in the Rafah refugee camp today. Israeli officials say the offensive in southern Gaza will continue until troops destroy tunnels along the border with Egypt that have been used for weapons smuggling. Israel is drawing international condemnation and dismay from the United States for shooting into a crowd of protesters in the refugee camp yesterday. Eight people were killed and many more wounded, including children. Joining us on the line is Meir Shlomo, Israeli Consul General in Boston. Welcome, Mr. Consul General.
Thank you.
We're hearing this morning from the government of Israel that it's apologizing for the deaths yesterday in Rafah, saying that its troops did not deliberately fire on marchers. So what happened?
Well, what happened is what sometimes unfortunately happens in a combat area. We must understand that Gaza these days is a combat area. And unfortunately, our troops did a mistake. And we deal with it like any democracy should deal with this kind of incidents. We apologized immediately. We offered immediately our assistance to evacuate those who were wounded. And we will deal with it. We will investigate why it happened. And we will make sure as much as we can that it will not happen again.
Well, some critics are wondering, as I'm sure you know, why the Israeli military would be in that area with such heavy weaponry, like tanks, in an area with a large civilian population.
Those critics would be well advised to remember that only last week we have lost 13 soldiers. 11 out of them were sitting in Humvees and still died out of a missile that was shot at them. So there's no question that we have to defend our soldiers when they are in the area. And there's no question that that the terrorist elements over there are trying to kill our soldiers.
The UN Security Council has condemned the loss of life and the demolition of homes in the Rafah area. And the United States abstained for the first time in nearly 2 years that it didn't exercise its veto on a resolution that was so sharply critical of Israel. What's your response?
Well, I think that one has to understand the situation which Israel is in order to fairly really judge what is right and what is wrong. To sit in the UN and condemn Israel from New York is precious easy. And unfortunately, the UN has not been very constructive in trying to impose on the Palestinians the notion that it's high time to get back to the negotiating table.
We're told that a majority of Israelis do favor withdrawal from Gaza. The Los Angeles Times editorialized this morning that it had been a disaster for Sharon and his government, especially following the vote that defeated his plan to remove settlements from there. What are you hearing as to what the discussion is now in Israel? I mean, clearly people must be braced for another round of violent retaliation after yesterday.
Well, I think that it is clear that Prime Minister Sharon had made a very bold move in offering the disengagement plan, which, by the way, was rejected by the Palestinians.
Well, when you see images, as the ones that we saw yesterday, of dead and injured children, I'm sure you're as horrified as everyone else, and these are images that are played over and over on Arab television. They're not seeing pictures of the tunnels, which is one of the reasons why Israeli troops say that they were in the area to begin with. Don't moves like this ultimately work against the national interest of Israel because of the outrage, because of the continued violence that follows?
No, it do not. I mean, of course, we were all horrified to see if a kid is hurt, it doesn't make any difference what is his nationality. Or what his religion is. It's devastating to see a kid hurt. But we must remember that the problem is not this image or another image on the TV and not any kind of PR spin. And by the way, the root of the conflict is not about territory. The root of the conflict is about the constant refusal of the Arab world to accept the very existence of Israel in that part of the world.
Mr. Consul General, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Meir Shlomo is Consul General for the Israeli government in Boston.
Well, images from Rafah on Israeli TV played in jarring contrast to the scene outside homes in the Arab town of Sakhnin in northern Israel. Thousands of Arab Israelis poured into the street, not in protest, but in celebration of the hometown soccer team. On Tuesday, the Sakhnin team, made up of 12 Israeli Arabs, 7 Israeli Jews, and 4 foreigners,
won the state cup, the first Arab-dominated soccer squad to do so. Pictures of the celebration pushed the Rafah images off the front pages of many papers by Wednesday. Joining us on the line is Frankie Sachs. He's sports editor for the Jerusalem Post. And Frankie, you know, the New York Times writes, of course, this win doesn't counterbalance the events in Rafah for the Arab population or anyone. But what does it do? How is this win resonating?
Well, it brought about a sense of national pride for a lot of the Israeli Arabs. There were about 35,000 people at the game, and the fans were overwhelmingly Sakhnin supporters from all over the country. As you said, it's a small town, only about 24,000 residents, but there were people that came from Jerusalem, from the south, from all over neighboring villages in the north, all coming to support this team. And really, it was just a showing of Arab national pride.
You were at Tuesday night's game, where, by the way, Sakhnin beat Hapoel Haifa 4-1.
Yeah.
And this was happening as the Israeli tanks were rolling into Rafah. Paint the scene for us. Did the people there know that? What was the mood?
People could have known. Anyone who wanted, had a radio, knew mm-hmm. people driving to the game may have heard. But once you entered the stadium, you sort of entered a whole different dimension. The outside world wasn't really relevant for the few hours of the game.
Tell me a little bit about this team and how they came to be.
Well, the team, it's really a small town team, and over the course of 10 years, they've risen up five different levels of division soccer to reach the top level. And what they've really accomplished this year, in addition to the cup, is they've become the first Arab-Israeli team to succeed in staying up and not being relegated to a lower division after 1 year in the top league. The bigger story here is not so much of it being an Arab-Israeli team, but this small town team. Not too many people from the town have all come together to rally within the small town and become like one big family and then win this title.
Is it too facile to say, this is a demonstration of what can happen?
I think so, because when it comes down to it, sports, and sports really transcends reality. For many years now, there have been several Arab Israelis who have represented the Israeli national team. With the exception of one soccer team in Israel, which is notoriously racist, all the other teams have had Arab Israeli players. Several of them have many Arab Israeli players and have youth training setups in Arab towns to bring players with them. But it is important to note that the team that they beat had almost as many Arab players as Sakhnin did, including one Sakhnin native who played for the Haifa side. So it's a great story for the international news to pump up that the small Arab minority has taken this title. But like I said, it's a great sports story more than it's a story about an Arab minority, because fortunately in Israel, the sports has transcended the political reality.
Right. We understand that Prime Minister Sharon congratulated the team after their win. They're now going to be one of four teams to represent Israel in Europe's UEFA Cup. It's the first time Israel will be represented by a team associated with the Arab minority. But others are quick to point out, hey, don't congratulate us. Apparently the team doesn't have a pretty good field to play on.
Well, one of the first things that the management did when Sharon called to congratulate was to ask that he help them raise the missing 7 million shekel they would need to build their stadium. But again, I can't think of too many cities in Israel that are smaller than 25,000 residents that have a suitable grounds to host matches.
Mm. Frankie, thank you.
Thank you.
Frankie Sachs is sports editor for the Jerusalem Post.
Stay with us. There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Private contractors have been a key part of the war and post-war effort in Iraq. This week, a group of Democratic congressmen, including Congressman Henry Waxman of California, released a report accusing the government of failing to make sure contractors are actually doing the work they're paid to do.
We've been very involved in looking at these contractors in Iraq, and there's so many independent contractors in Iraq that the government can't keep track of whether they are charging appropriately and doing good quality work. So rather than hire auditors to follow up on what these contractors are doing, they're hiring contractors to follow the contractors. And in some cases, the contractors they're hiring are doing business with the contractors they're supposed to monitor in other parts of the world or the United States, which puts them in a conflict of interest position, not one that you would want to rely on if you're really trying to protect the public taxpayers' dollar.
Joining us on the line from Washington is Angela Stiles, who was head of the federal office that makes the rules on how the government hands out work to private contractors. Stiles left her position with the Office of Management and Budget in September and now works in the private sector representing companies seeking government contract work. Welcome, Angela.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us first, what do you think is good and what's troubling about the government's use of these private contractors?
Well, I think it's good because it fulfills a need, particularly in Iraq. You've got to mobilize. You've got to deliver food. I think the private sector supports the government in almost every aspect of what it does, and you bring private sector innovation to the table. The concern is that there really aren't sufficient people in the government to either draft or manage these contractors.
So is it a matter of, to pull out an old phrase from Soviet arms control negotiations, trust but verify?
I think that's exactly right. I think that we have to recognize that the private sector is a fundamental part of providing government services, whether that's at the military or whether that's at the IRS, but you need to make sure that you're getting the best deal for the taxpayer.
Well, as you know, Congressman Henry Waxman and others are complaining that there's a lot of conflict of interest going on here, that companies that are doing business with some of these contractors are now being asked to oversee them. Do you see that as the problem?
I think it can be a problem. Certainly, it's the government's responsibility to oversee and audit with government people, not other contractors, and to make sure that they are managing these contracts from the government's perspective and from the taxpayer's perspective.
Are there enough people in the government with that kind of expertise to do that effectively?
I don't think so. I don't think the government has the expertise to know what they need to write the contract or to manage many of these contracts.
Well, now, what happens in the contract process? Because I understand that very often a contract might be drawn up, but then it's added to, it's amended, it's changed, and that's really where things get out of control.
Well, even worse than that, I think that some agencies, it's the point that the government asks the contractor, what do we need? They don't even write the requirements for what the government needs. They go out to the private sector and say, tell us what you need, and then implement that.
Mm. Well, is this problem just in Iraq, or is this across the board?
I think it's a much more significant problem in the federal government. It's only exacerbated and highlighted in Iraq, but I think it's important because you can take some lemons maybe that you find in Iraq and make some very positive changes to the system as a result.
Are there any examples of the process working the way it's supposed to?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are, for example, some of the larger defense contractors, whether that's Boeing or Lockheed Martin or Raytheon, they have hundreds of federal auditors from the defense contract auditing agencies that reside in their buildings, that work with them day in and day out to make sure that everything is the way it's supposed to be. But there are other companies in the management service arena or in the information technology arena that don't have any auditors, that have no one that looks at their contracts.
So some areas are managed very well, and others it's just, what, nothing?
That's right.
Hmm. And can you give me a sense of what you did on a daily basis? I mean, was this your job to sit in your office and scrutinize these contracts line by line yourself?
It was more a matter of looking at the regulatory process to make sure that we had the regulations in place and that people were trained and understood what the regulations were. And I can tell you that the regulations aren't the hard part. The hard part is making sure that people follow them, that they're incentivized to get the best deal for the taxpayer, and they're incentivized to create arm's-length transactions with the private sector and do the right thing. It is very hard, and there is a long learning curve, I think, in the federal procurement arena. It's hard to recruit, it's hard to pay, and it's hard to retain people to be contracting officers and contract managers.
Is there a way to fix this?
I think so. I think the field has to be more attractive. I think the people have to be better paid. I think the federal government has to realize that it's vitally important to have people within the agencies that understand what they're buying. If you don't understand what you're buying, you can't draft a contract, and you certainly can't manage it.
So spend some money to save some money.
That's right.
And did you find your own frustrations with this situation such that that's one of the reasons why you left the job?
Certainly, it added to the stress of my job trying to make sure that the federal government did a good job of managing $240 billion in purchases from the private sector.
Well, that sounds like an almost impossible job.
I think many days it was an almost impossible job to try and make sure that we were doing the best job we could for the taxpayers.
All right. Thank you very much, Angela.
Thank you.
Angela Stiles is the former head of the Office of Federal Procurement Policy in the Office of Management and Budget.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, Sending Money Home. A new study looks at the massive amount of money pouring into Latin America from immigrant workers in the U.S., transforming parts of that region.
Also, she was a 15-year-old actress when she appeared in the Jim Jarmusch film Stranger Than Paradise. 20 years later, she's a singer with a devoted following. We'll meet Esther Ballant.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee has been hearing testimony this week about the U.S. effort in Iraq. Among those testifying, Anthony Cordesman of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Cordesman has a decades-long resume of work in the Department of Defense, in Congress, and in the Middle East. You might call him the Dean of Iraq Watchers. Usually measured, sometimes critical, sometimes upbeat, Cordesman delivered a startling broadside in yesterday's hearings.
It may be too late to deal with the most serious problem we face within the United States government. The fact that a small group of neoconservative ideologues were able to substitute their illusions for an effective planning effort by professionals using the interagency process. Some 40 years ago, I entered the office of the Secretary of Defense at a time when an equally small group of neoliberals were able to do the same thing. These best and the brightest trapped us into a losing war, and their names were written invisibly on the body bag of every American who died in that conflict. This time it is neoconservatives, not neoliberals, who trapped us into a war without setting realistic and obtainable goals, without a realistic and workable approach to creating stability, security, and nation building. And once again, we find that the end result is that incompetence kills just as effectively as malice.
Anthony Cordesman joins us now on the line from Washington. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, as we've said, you have been quite measured in your comments in the past. What prompted you to pull out all the stops yesterday?
The problem that I'm reacting to, and I've just come back from the Gulf, that General Hoare reacted to, that the other witnesses acted to, including Larry Diamond, who is with the CPA, is we have very little time, very urgent tasks to do. The odds are not good if we do respond as effectively as possible. And this is a war which is involving hundreds of American casualties, close to 800 at this point, and some 4,000 American wounded. it's a conflict which is risking something on the order of $20 or more billion worth of aid, and the strategic implications are critical. It's not something where we can afford to sort of ignore just how urgent the situation has become.
You also, in your testimony, compared this administration to the neoliberals who ran the Vietnam War 40 years ago. What do you see as the most striking parallels?
A triumph of belief over analysis, trying to enforce ideas developed almost in theory on a region, on a practical case, without regard to whether they're workable. Finding reasons to believe that the ideology is correct regardless of the evidence. And let me stress that this is not an administration which has these beliefs. It's quite clear that the State Department, much of the military, much of the intelligence community, does not share the same neoconservative and their ideas of elements within the Vice President's office, the National Security Council, and OSD. And even within those offices, I should be clear, there are many very practical neoconservatives. Our problem is there are still these cadres of ideologues whose belief structure simply doesn't track with reality.
Is it fixable at this point?
Is it possible that it can be fixed? Yes, very much so. And some of the initiatives we're taking are very important. If we don't couple them, however, to broader political and ideological efforts to show the Iraqis we're not occupiers, we're not after their oil, we're not going to have bases, we may still fail. If we don't understand how important the Arab-Israeli peace process is to changing Iraqi and Arab perceptions, and if we go off and start yet another grandiose, vague ideological effort like a Greater Middle East initiative on the same ideological basis that we failed with in Iraq, well, we can lose when we don't have to.
I wonder, looking back, do you regret not being more critical before now because you are someone who people listen to?
Well, I think the problem was then, and to some extent now, that people don't seem to understand that it is where we are 5 to 10 years from now that counts, not whether we win tactically in Fallujah or we can defeat Sadr. But you can give all the warnings you want about the need to talk about peace and the final outcome as the key purpose of war. And if people don't listen, it doesn't matter.
Anthony, we can't let you go here without asking about the latest news from Israel, the violence in Gaza yesterday that resulted in 10 people dead. Some commentators in the Arab world are now comparing that violence with the airstrike on what may have been an Iraqi wedding party. They're looking at these two events as an example of, see, the Americans are out to kill us everywhere in concert with Israel. Do you see any way out here?
Well, let me be very clear. Israel faces truly serious security threats. Nobody can ignore that, and many of its actions are justified. I think that this government of Israel has failed to pursue the peace process. It is too divided to be effective. In many ways, it's almost as weak as the Palestinian government. And it is true that there have been tactical mistakes and excesses by the Israelis, as there have by the U.S. forces. But the way out, I think, is to give the peace process the highest possible priority, because ultimately Israel's security interests, like those of the Palestinians, require both states to be viable, and this means American pressure to end the settlements and to limit the use of force. But our whole image in the region is dominated not so much by the fact we are allied to Israel, but by the fact people simply do not believe that we are seriously committed to making a balanced effort to win a peace that will meet both Israel's needs and those of the Palestinians.
In essence, then, the United States has to do something about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict before it can hope to accomplish much else in the Middle East.
Well, the problem is not sequence. This is a very complex region, and if we don't really deal with it in complex terms, if we effectively can't walk and chew gum, then we open ourselves up to defeat.
Anthony, thank you.
Thank you.
Anthony Cordesman is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C.
Still to come, his fellow students in college hated it, so he put it in a drawer. Now Tennessee Williams' first play is staged.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
First, this correction. In our report on yesterday's court-martial of U.S. Army Reserve Specialist Jeremy Sivitz, we said three other soldiers had been arraigned and reportedly were refusing to testify. Well, three soldiers were arraigned in Iraq yesterday, but they were not the soldiers who had refused to testify. The people who refused to testify in the prison scandal, two officers and a civilian contractor, were being asked to testify in a previous secret hearing in April.
Our story on Justice of the Peace Linda Gray Kelly of Charlton, Massachusetts, who resigned her position rather than perform same-sex marriages, brought this email from Leslie Stalhut of Wilson, North Carolina. Kelly said that she had to resign as a matter of conscience because marriage had been defined as being between one man and one woman for thousands of years. Well, if she decides to read the Old Testament, she'll discover that polygamy was acceptable at one time. Further, if she studies law, she'll see that it was once an institution primarily for those who were economically well-heeled and that the poor and enslaved were not permitted to marry. Since Kelly has so little knowledge about the history of marriage, I think it's just as well that she resigned her post.
Many of you wrote after yesterday's talk with Harvard professor Samuel Huntington about his new book, Who Are We? The Challenges to America's National Identity. Huntington said the Anglo-Protestant culture is the foundation of America. Well, that bothered Noreen Bladergroen of Boston.
What I guess bothered me about his description was the idea that unless one came from that Anglo-Protestant background or culture, that one was not capable of understanding or supporting ideas of liberty, work ethic, equality. And I think these days, trying to find places where we share values across cultures is more productive than trying to define how we are so different from others.
Jennifer Freed of Holden, Massachusetts, thanked us for our coverage of the Abu Ghraib prison scandal and for our interview with Stanford University professor Philip Zimbardo, who did a landmark study that showed ordinary students quickly becoming abusive in prison-like situations. Jennifer writes, "It is not justified, and perhaps it's not even moral, to blame the abuse in Iraq on a few bad apples. What we should be saying to ourselves is not, 'I would never do that,' but 'Would I ever? Could I?' Only by asking the uncomfortable questions do we acknowledge the possibility of the behavior, and by acknowledging the possibility, we help guard against it."
And finally, following a recent segment in which pop critic Tim Riley contended that some of the best rock music is punk, Tim cited new CDs by Courtney Love and Loretta Lynn in collaboration with Jack White of the band The White Stripes. We received this outraged email from Dan Cahoon of Glen Mills, Pennsylvania, who writes, "The White Stripes are not punk rock. They're merely regurgitating garage rock for the 11 billionth time and doing it worse than the people who came before. About the only person mentioned who is punk rock is Loretta Lynn, and she was punk rock even before there was such a thing as punk rock. Punk rock is not just an attitude. It is about rejection of fashion and effect. It's about doing it for yourself." Well, for yourself, here's the title track, Bandleer Rose, from Loretta Lynn's new CD, with Jack White of the White Stripes. She'd walk across the coal miner's yard. Them miners would yell loud and hard, and they'd dream of who would hold the Bandleer Rose.
As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town where you live.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Today, a 3-day waiting period expires for same-sex couples who applied for marriage licenses in Massachusetts on Monday. And if most of those couples are women, it won't be much of a surprise. 2/3 of Monday's marriages were lesbian couples. Dr. David Greenan joins us to explain why. He's a psychologist and family therapist and director of the Mnuchin Center for the Family in New York City. Dr. Greenan specializes in working with same-sex couples. And, Doctor, why are there so many more women than men getting married?
The short answer, I think, is that women have a lot to teach men about intimacy and what it means to be dependent and how to negotiate those relationships. I think it's also a very complicated issue that has to do with not only how men become acculturated, how gender acculturation occurs in Western society, but also the events that occur for gay men around gay identity formation. In spite of the recent trends, perhaps, with metrosexuals, the vast majority of men in our culture, I think, are taught at a very young age to be independent and to be what's sometimes referred to as the sturdy oak, and to not allow oneself to be too vulnerable around other men. That, combined with the experiences of what it means to be gay and growing up knowing that one is queer and different from other men, and often there are many shameful experiences that occur around one's needs to be close and intimate with another man, create some real obstacles, I think, in negotiating adult relationships, never having had the experiences of dating as children and as adolescents, rather. And so in adulthood, I think that we tend to shy away from bonds that create, feel as though that we might recreate earlier traumatic experiences. And certainly marriage is one way of coming out in the world that can be very scary for men.
Well, it almost sounds as if this is the gay community's version of the same kind of commitment issues that straight couples often encounter.
Yes. You know, in some ways, we're not that different. A couple's a couple, and I think that we often see these needs and disparity of needs being expressed in heterosexual couples.
Do you think that many couples in the gay community right now are feeling pressure to marry? You know, now you can. Why don't you?
Yes. You know, that obviously is there, that that people are going to feel that there's a political gauntlet that's been thrown down, and, you know, there's a certain amount of pressure to pick that up. And in fact, I think gay people may be experiencing that more right now than perhaps heterosexual people are.
Although just because you can do something doesn't necessarily mean you should.
Absolutely. And certainly there are many people, both gay and straight, who feel as though that the institution of marriage has a lot to be worked out and that it's not relevant for a lot of the issues that people are coping with in today's society.
Doctor, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Dr. David Greenan is a psychologist and family therapist and director of the Mnuchin Center for the Family in New York City.
You think I'm ludicrous, don't you?
No, I think you're fake.
A fake?
Yes, an absolute fake.
You're right. I am a fake. I haven't got a real bone in my body.
I know you haven't.
You know, it surprises me sometimes to see that I even make a shadow in the light.
Before there was a cat on a hot tin roof and a streetcar named Desire, back when Tennessee Williams was still Tom Williams and not yet a college graduate, he wrote Spring Storm. The play was ambitious, with more than 20 distinct characters and several complicated sets. But his college playwriting seminar hated it, and he shelved the play and died before it was ever staged. Now the play has moved from a desk drawer to the New York stage with a few stops in between. Coy Middlebrook is the director of the production at Theater at St. Clements. He joins us on the line from New York City. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be with you this afternoon.
And we know you also really breathed life into this play. How exciting is it for you're a young theater person to be doing the first, you know, it's a New York premiere of a Tennessee Williams play.
It's a dream come true, and it's just a thrill and a privilege and an honor to breathe the life into this play and to present it to the New York theater community.
Well, tell us a little bit about Spring Storm. Can you sum it up for us?
It's about four young doomed lovers in a Depression-era Delta town in the Mississippi. And it's really the first of, you see seed after seed after seed of the characters that Tennessee will bring to the American theater later in his masterpieces. You see Alma in Summer and Smoke. You see Stanley in Streetcar Named Desire. You see little glints of Blanche. You see Amanda in The Glass Menagerie.
Foreshadowing the future characters that we've come to know.
Yes.
Is it good?
Yes, it is good. I mean, it's somewhat wandering. It's a young playwright. He's overwritten. He's overstated. There's a lot of repetition, but we've tackled that. We've done a lot of judicious cutting, and really tried to just streamline the action and the plot. So a lot of the plot events are much closer together. But the story does grab you, and it's quite a thrilling and courageous story. The central character, the one lover of the four that is at the epicenter of the story. She is a young woman who is trying to not deny her sexual awakening, and in a delta town, in a very conservative small town with the mores and social values of that time, it was quite a courageous front on her part, and she is really the first of Tennessee's rebels.
We mentioned this was early Tennessee Williams, and one of your actresses commented that early Tennessee Williams is so much better than late almost anyone else.
Yeah, and so true. I mean, many of my colleagues and more established friends of mine in the theater community, they were, why this play, Coy? Why not The Glass Menagerie if you love Tennessee Williams? And this play in particular, first of all, it is a premiere, and that is exciting for us to bring to the community. But it's also, in particular with this play, there is an opportunity for young actors on Tennessee Williams. Often in his later works, the characters are more mature. Mm. Here we have four young people on stage, and there are there is a whole town of people in the play, but it centers around these four young actors, and it's an opportunity for young actors and myself, a young director, to work on Williams. Which is not so present in right. some of his other greater works.
What did Tennessee Williams himself say about the play?
He pretty much put it in a drawer and forgot about it, and he said that he was quite embarrassed by the rejection of his classmates and his professor at the University of Iowa when he read the final draft. And there was, at the end of the reading, a very long, long silence. And he perceived this as their rejection of the play. Often when something powerful happens, there mm-hmm. is quiet. There is silence that overcomes the moment. Mm. Most of his formative years was in his grandfather's home, and his grandfather was an Episcopalian minister, and he grew up in a very repressed environment, and this is a play that is a cry of independence.
We understand it's very passionate, it has a violence in it, and also a violent storm.
There's a violent storm, there's passion, there's a lot of sexual awakening and passion in it that I think, you know, at the time, reading it in class, it was, you know, his professor, after he read it, after the silence, said, every great artist has to paint their nude. Mm. And so, you know, he regarded this as his nude, and he then, you know, put it somewhere.
Thank goodness he didn't get discouraged by that first, what he thought was rejection. You said it might have just been, they didn't know what to make of it. But, you know, because we understand that this is the first time he actually wrote in an autobiographical way or from his own experience?
Yes, this is really when you, if you have any sense of his history and his lineage, you begin to see in this play first where he is speaking from his own experience and from his own, the people that were around him and surrounded him when he grew. It's really quite an archaeological find in terms of archaeological theater, because you see not only his what he becomes and what his characters will become, but you do see his life in this play for the first time.
This has been staged in small theaters in other parts of the country. What gripped you about it?
I've shared a fondness for him and his work. I share his birthday, and theater saved my life as a young boy in rural Northern California. And I can remember in my 15th birthday, I realized that I shared my birthday with Tennessee Williams. I got one of those cards that list all the famous people you share your birthday with. When I was in grad school, this came across with Krista Lambden, a fellow alum of mine who is starring as Heavenly, the lead character. I just wanted so much to breathe life into it and to have an opportunity to work on the play. And Aunt Lila says at the very end of the play, she says, you must grab a hold of things you want, and it's the reason why nature gave you two arms. Mm-hmm. And I really held on to that. And we just tried to grab hold of it and try to come from it from a very pure place. And my hope is that Tennessee honors and recognizes that in whatever presence he may have above us.
Mm-hmm. Well, Coy Middlebrook, thank you.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Coy Middlebrook, director of Tennessee Williams' Spring Storm. It's playing at Theater at St. Clements in New York City until May 29th.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.